Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Welcome to another program in the award-winning series of Listen to Older Voices. I'm Rob Greaves and this is program number 1093. And it features the life and times of Baby Boomer and New Zealand-born and Australian adopted iconic musician, Mike Rudd. Mike was born in New Zealand and cut his musical teeth in that country before arriving in Australia in the mid-ish 1960s, where he formed the brilliant and much-loved Spectrum, going on to create and head a number of other well-known and much-loved groups. In this part of Mike's story, as related by him, we learn that the genesis of his musical career actually started with him as a young chorister. But with the massive music changes sweeping through during the 1960s, he knew that being a musician in a band was what he really wanted. We learn how he made his first guitar, which wasn't exactly 100% usable, but he was hooked. Yet, in his words, the music he and his New Zealand band played was superficial pop. We learn of the circumstances that led to Mike leaving what he describes as the dark cellar of a rented house in New Zealand to come to Australia, where, very quickly, his career started to blossom. Without much more ado, here I am, speaking with Mike Rudd. First of all, Mike, thank you very much for inviting me into your home. Could I start by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
I was born on the 15th of June 1945 at St George's Hospital in Christchurch, New Zealand.
What would be your earliest recollections of life?
Our mother had been divorced after living with our father for about 3 minutes. And I say our because this is myself and my brother Richard, who's 18 months my junior. And so we actually went to a number of schools because our mother was a relief teacher and we tended to sort of follow her around the place and in our primary school years anyway. So it may have been 7 or 8 schools that I went to, or we both went to. And so it probably accounts for the our kind of gypsy-like non-attachment to people, because we just didn't have time to attach to anybody, get to know anybody. We were sort of blow in and blow out again.
Did that result in you getting close to your brother? Was it the lack of friends?
Look, we were always close, but, you know, it takes a while sometimes for these things to filter through. It was only comparatively recently he revealed to me that he was, that I constantly bullied him. And well, I'm a fairly nice kind of bloke, but you're a nice bloke when you're winning all the time. So I didn't really take that too seriously, but it was quite a serious issue for him. But we mended up okay, and we get on really well these days, particularly because he lives in Melbourne as well. In fact, in North Warrandyte.
What about Mum? What sort of person was your mother?
Well, she married again and she had, 3 or 4 other children. Maria might even be able to remind me.
Three.
And they still live in New Zealand.
Right.
She ended up in Auckland. Her second husband died not too long ago, actually, either, but she was a fiercely independent woman. She was a single child, born on a sheep station in North Canterbury. And she was a pioneering spirit for a woman in those days, probably because she was single as well,
you know, yes,
and didn't have any companions. So she did a lot of things, and she was doing a lot of things until comparatively recently as well. She was a yachting woman.
Goodness.
And she did solo yachting, and she had wine clubs, and her second husband was in the wine importing business. So, yeah, she was highly qualified in that area as well.
Sounds like she was quite a dynamic woman then.
Yes, she was, yes. But my brother and I found we were left in Christchurch at when we were secondary school students, and the family moved away from us, so
right.
We were deserted, but we were left with our grandmother, who was a doting grandmother.
Was life with grandmother as a young boy make up for not having mum, or were you aware that mum wasn't around?
Well, this was in latter. In fact, I think we were just about to go to university. Well, I say university.
Oh, arts, okay. So you're fairly grown up.
Yeah, we're kind of grown up.
Okay.
And we knew how to take advantage.
Oh, okay. Oh, I bet you did. What was your schooling experience like, given you were moving so often? Did you enjoy the experience of going to school?
No, I didn't particularly, although I got on okay at school. The big change for me was when my mother took me to audition for singing in the choir at the Christchurch Anglican Cathedral, the one that was so severely damaged in the second earthquake in particular. And I spent 4 years being a chorister, and that's when we kind of settled down, because I went to, and my brother went to Cathedral Grammar School, which was a prep school, and then subsequent to that we went to Christ College, which was a private school, and obviously our grandfather had looked after us in that respect. So, I kind of enjoyed school, and yet I didn't like it that much either. So, yeah, I've got kind of mixed feelings about school days.
Would you say you were academically inclined? Did you?
In particular areas I excelled, in other areas I was a total disappointment. So,
sounds like most of us at school. Yeah.
So I was streamed in the bottom classes for mathematics, physics, chemistry, and in the top classes for English, history, geography, blah, blah.
Mm.
And art, of course. Because my brother and I both went to art school when we left school.
How old would you have been then, roughly?
I would have been 19, I think.
Okay, so we're talking about the fact that you're into the 60s.
Yeah, oh yes.
When you did that. The 60s were a fairly dynamic period in Australia. For you in New Zealand, were you caught up in that almost tsunami of change that was sweeping around the young people in terms of both the social changes and the music changes that came through, particularly from Britain?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And look, it was a time of change, and I didn't feel any compulsion to go out and work in the same gig as my dad had worked in, which is, you know, up until the Second World War, that's what you basically did. You did what your father did.
That's right.
But our father had left the scene pretty early in any case, so we didn't have any particular modelling in that area. And we both had an affinity for art, my brother and I. And so we leapt into art school, and then I sought to move away from that with music. So after being a chorister for 4 years, that was so intense that I actually retreated from formal music study.
Intense in what way?
Took a lot of time. We were occupied doing practicing and actual services during the week. So when most kids would be going home, we'd be going to practice, and I'd be catching a sort of comparatively late bus home. Or when we were going to Christ College, both we lived up on Cashmere Hills. Christchurch is a very flat city, but it has a sort of surrounding hills, very much like Adelaide, and we lived up in Cashmere Hills, which is comparatively elite.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the joy of cycling into town down the hill, but then had to walk up again.
What goes down must come up.
Indeed.
So you never had it in your mind to do anything but in the creative arts area?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Did you get a job in that area before music?
No.
While
I was at art school, I was bringing a portable record player to art school and saying, listen to this. And my mind wasn't totally on the job. In fact, I was there for 2 years. At the end of the second year, I was studying graphic design, and I forgot to submit about four things, and they said, well, look, normally we'd be failing you and you'd be out, but we think you've got initiative anyway, and so you can come back and repeat those particular units. But at that stage, I was so into playing that I thought, no, I'm out of here.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Mike Rudd, who has been recalling his early years in New Zealand and how he followed his desire to be a musician.
Do you remember getting your first guitar and what the circumstances were?
Yes. Again, my brother and I had passed this, it wasn't even a music store, but it had a couple of acoustic guitars which had sort of a Mexican motif on them, and we thought, wow, that's great. So I think we both bought the same model acoustic guitar, and I can remember practicing until my, you know, the fingers bled thing. And then I thought, well, electric guitar, that would be something. And there weren't very many electric guitars around. So I actually built my own by taking the neck off that guitar and sticking it on, you know, a board that I'd designed, and found a pickup and tightened up the strings, and the neck just went, chip.
You had me there. I thought, okay, I want to hear how this went, but now I understand.
But it did actually work, but it was I could only play it on one position on the fretboard. It was so horrible.
But that was pretty innovative for you.
As I said,
I guess circumstances.
There really weren't that many models around that we could even look at. So we used to get Australasian Post, which is our big window into Australia, and they had occasional pictures of guitarists and players playing guitars. I'm going to build one of those.
Right.
And I'm useless with my hands. I am absolutely hopeless, but I was sufficiently motivated to make my own guitar.
Well, you must have been highly motivated. So how did you move from that early experimentation building your own to actually buying one? Because you weren't working. Where did the money come from?
Well, I have to make a confession that I was on a bursary, a teaching bursary, when I went to art school.
Right.
And I was getting a subsistence kind of wage then, but that was enough. And then the band that I put together, we got a regular gig in town, and it was a situation that we enjoyed for the next 2 or 3 years.
What was the name of that band?
Well, it became The Chants, and then later still Chants R&B. So when I say Chants, I say it's spelt C-H-A-N-T-S, Chants,
yes,
of course.
Yes, of course.
I have to translate for Australians all the time.
You do, we're not that smart. So again, for contextual purposes, roughly where are we? Are we in the mid-60s or the late-60s?
Let me think. 63, 64, around about that era, 64, maybe even 65.
Who was influencing you then musically?
Well, got him together with a young drummer. When I say young, he was still at school, Trevor Courtney.
Hmm.
You may have heard of him.
Oh, definitely.
And he and I used to send over to... we used to get copies of Melody Maker and send over for the latest albums and so forth from England. It must have been hilarious for them, because we used to send over actual New Zealand money, which was absolutely worthless over there. But they took pity on us and sent us out these albums. So we were actually quite a bit ahead of anything that was released in New Zealand at the time. And that became the kind of basis of what the band played.
And what were those albums? I mean, what style of music or what groups?
Well, I heard the first Who album, which I was just absolutely mesmerised by, and I still regard the Who as one of the greatest rock bands of all time. And then possibly even more inspiring was the John Mayall and the Blues Breakers album, which, you know, again, as soon as I heard those first notes, I'd never heard anything like that before. Having said that, I was extremely superficial as far as pop music went, because we were getting, in Christchurch, we had available to us Americans at the Antarctic base in Christchurch. They used to use that as a jumping off spot. So they brought a lot of stuff with them. But I never heard any of that. That was kind of like the dark side of Christchurch. And I never went there. So I was absolutely just totally superficially involved with pop music, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of went in through we started off being a Beatles kind of band, then a Rolling Stones kind of band, and then we started to look for other things, and we plumped for the Pretty Things, who were, they were so off the radar that we thought that, that they were fantastic. And then they toured New Zealand in one of those package tours with Sandy Shaw, Eden Kane, and two or three New Zealand acts. And their drummer, Viv Prince, was probably the most interesting part of the band in a sense, because he decided that as soon as he landed, he was going to be pissed all the way around New Zealand, which he was. And he bought a lobster, which he called his pet lobster, put it on the lead, and he dragged it around through the whole tour, which, of course, was devastatingly smelly. And he spent most of his time being a human publicity machine. And they just got headlines everywhere. He set fire to curtains and while in venues that they were playing. And he was a thoroughly wild drummer. And I reckon it's probably 100% right that he would have been the prototype for Keith Moon. And he actually got a band in New Zealand. They sent him out of New Zealand, but that they put him on this plane, and he was so pissed on the plane, they had to throw him off the plane again.
Oh, gosh. Oh, they were the band our parents hated.
Yeah, well, that's right. And they weren't allowed into Australia.
They
created so much mayhem in New Zealand. But to us, they were a huge influence in New Zealand, I have to say.
Right. So did the Chants mould their music on that, or did that lead you into another group at that stage?
The thing with having a residency for that long is you can do whatever you like, and you have your audience there, and they just accept whatever you do. So that was only part of what we did. We tackled soul music, regular pop music. We just did everything, but kind of put it through the Chants mincer.
In Australia, we were very self-centred in terms of our music, and Melbourne was, in our world, and to some degree it was true, it was the music capital of the Southern Hemisphere, and gave little attention to New Zealand at that stage, but it had a really thriving, vibrant scene, didn't it?
It did, and occasionally Australian bands popped over to New Zealand and appeared on the one TV show that there was to appear on. But we were so happily ensconced in our residency, we didn't take any notice of anything else that was going on around us. And I think that kind of gave us a bit of an advantage, because we could just do anything we felt like.
Right.
Listen to Older Voices, living history on Ageless Radio.
And then an amazing circumstance happened. Our first guitarist, who was considerably older than the rest of us, was a teacher. Decided this was all too unseemly, and he was going to leave the band. But he left after we'd found another guitarist who happened to be an Australian. And he was in a band visiting town called the Kelly Brothers, which should have given us a tip. But anyway, he called himself Max Kelly. And he was the fastest guitarist I'd ever heard in my life. And I thought, wow, this is okay. We've got the fastest guitarist I've ever heard in my life. And so he joined fairly seamlessly. But one morning I was lying in my rented house and in bed, and these two blokes turned up in trench coats and said, can you tell us where Matt Croke is? And I said, no, who's Matt Croke? He said, you might know him better as Max Kelly. And apparently he'd been an apprentice with the RAAF, and he was on leave in New Zealand, and he'd overstayed his leave, and his mother had sent the minions of the law to pick him up, which they did, and delivered him in Sydney, and he was dumped in Holsworthy. Mm. But that was my excuse to move out of our cellar, our dank cellar, to Australia. Big move. So I was entitled to an inheritance when I turned 21. So we'll be able to actually work out the years by this. And I had enough money to buy tickets for the band and take, and it was a ludicrous thing, we took our gear over with us and landed in Melbourne.
You land in Melbourne.
What 1966.
And a good time to come to Melbourne because it really was exploding then in terms of the startup venues. I mean, we'd gone from move from the town hall scene into the Melbourne's discotheque scene, you know, clubs and things opening up everywhere. So what was your first impressions of Melbourne?
Oh, look, we were slightly nervous about it because the other magazine that we used to read was Pix, and they had all these stories about Sharpies and versus the mods and so forth. And so we had outrageously long hair before we arrived, but we sort of cut it all back. And are we okay now? but, you know, it was really exciting. And, you know, places like Birdie, well, actually it wasn't Birdie's at that stage. Sebastian's was going, the Thumping Tum, the Catcher, those places were all happening. And there were town halls all around the city that were going flat out. And I remember seeing the Loved Ones at Sebastian's. And I was just so impressed. I thought they were fantastic. And fantastically original, because we weren't original at all. We'd done a bit of recording in New Zealand, but hardly anything of our own. So even though the term hadn't been discovered then, we were a cover band.
Mm.
And I was just so knocked out by these guys. But the scene was it was weird in the sense it was very exciting. But a band like the Loved Ones couldn't actually have any kind of reality other than a half-hour spot here, another half-hour spot there, another half-hour spot there. They were doing the same routine, a bit like the Beatles, in fact.
Yes.
When they came over, they were doing a half-hour set.
That's right.
And that's all they got the chance to do, and they were such a creative band, it just killed them, I think.
Yes.
That's my guess, anyway.
As I said, the period you came over was a great period to land here because things were really happening. And it's interesting that you mentioned how you saw the Loved Ones as a creative band as opposed to cover band, because I think we look back at that period now and we see those bands that grew up in Melbourne that didn't make that transition into starting to create their own music folded and died away. So how long did it take you to start thinking, gee, I've got to start designing my own material?
Well, I didn't do anything with the band as it was then, but we were faced as a band who'd been in a residency for 2 years to try and make a choice about which direction we were going to go in. And the band actually split within 6 months from musical differences, really and truly. Trevor and I were great mates, but we kind of went in totally different directions. I wanted to go in a blues direction, he wanted to go in a soul direction, so the band actually split up. And I joined the Party Machine as bass player. Now, at that stage, they weren't doing a lot of their own stuff, but 2 years later, they were doing 90% of their own stuff, and that's where my vision for my own stuff came from, although I had barely written anything yet by the time that the Party Machine split as well.
Right, that period in the Party Machine, do you look back at that fondly?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I joined the band, Ross Hannaford was probably about Ross Wilson's size, and he just kept on growing. and he was a little bit chubby as well. But he was always an authentic player. I just loved what he played, and even more particularly what he left out. He was just an absolute artist on the guitar, and his attitude to everything was curious. He was very curious, and he wanted to know how things worked, and he was just a real artist, I thought.
Yeah.
I often wonder what would have happened had he been just taken out and put in front of an audience of people that knew what they were looking at. Yeah, who knows? But because he did kind of get the chance with Daddy Cool going to the States, but you know, a series of, I don't know whether you've read the the book. But look, that wasn't the best time for them to be over there.
No, no, it was a bit of a taking coals to Newcastle, as they say.
Oh, yeah, yes, but nonetheless, had they gone a year or so earlier when they were at their height, instead of going, oh, what are we going to do next, it might have been a different story.
Did Frank Zappa ever have any effect on you?
No, only indirectly, because he had a big influence on Ross Wilson at that stage, and some of his more curious numbers had kind of a Zappa-esque feel about
it. That's why I asked, because that came to mind when you mentioned the Party Machine and Ross, and I thought, he really did experiment that area, and I wondered whether that took you with him.
In as much as it was him writing, and I think he was my biggest influence, not surprisingly, really, because that was my experience of playing.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program, and is podcast to you through the Toorak Times and TAG.